It's time now for Super Psychologist, Dr. Mara Karpel, and your golden years.
Good evening, and welcome to Dr. Mara Karpel and Your Golden Years. This evening and every Sunday evening at 5 p.m. Central Time and at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on blogtalkradio.com and on drmarakarpel.com. And today is April the 8th, and I hope you all had happy holidays while we were off last Sunday. And we are back in beautiful Austin, Texas, and Art Mendoza of Accomplice Entertainment, producer of this program, is here with us to make the show run. And I want to give a shout out and wish a very happy birthday to my childhood friend Laura, who's here visiting from out of town for her birthday. Happy birthday, Laura. And we have a really great show in store for you this evening. In a little while after the break, we'll be joined on the phone by best-selling author Rabbi Naomi Levy. And Naomi has appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show, the Today Show, and NPR, and she joins us from the West Coast today to talk about her latest book, Einstein and the Rabbi, Searching for the Soul. And in this book, as you'll hear, Rabbi Levy explores the meaning and purpose of the soul, which was inspired by a famous correspondence between Albert Einstein and a grieving father, whom she discovered was a remarkable hero during the Holocaust. We'll hear more about it. I don't want to give too much away, but the book is not just about this story, but it gives her insights for all of us to listen to our soul's yearning, no matter our religious faith. So I think this will be a really interesting interview, and I'm really excited to have her here to speak with us this evening. And then later in the program, bassist Kim Session will join us from right here in Austin, Texas, to talk about her music, and we'll be playing some of her original music. And along the way, I will talk about optimism and why it's good for your health. And I've spoken about it before on this program, and I've written about it, but hopefully tonight I can offer some new insights. And throughout this evening's program, we will have time to take your questions. So if you have any questions or comments for me or for my guests, please feel free to give a call. The toll-free number is 855-345-4720. That's 855-345-4720, or you can email your questions to me, and I will read them on the air. And my email address is Dr. Mara, that's D-R-M-A-R-A, at drmarakarpel.com, D-R-M-A-R-A-K-A-R-P-E-L. And be sure to get your questions to me in time so that I can read them to the guests, and she can answer them for you right here on the air. And you can hear this evening's program again by going to my web, and my website address is drmarakarpel.com. And I'll spell that again. It's drmarakarpel. And the link to the podcast, along with any information, website links, and any other important information given by both of my guests on the program, will be posted later tonight or early tomorrow morning. And you can hear the podcast of the show as soon as 5 minutes after the program ends by going directly to Blog Talk Radio, that's blogtalkradio.com/yourgoldenyears. And for information from previous programs and to read my blogs in Thrive Global and Huffington Post, to find out more about my upcoming book, which will be out in October, to watch videos of the interviews that we have done live in the studio here in Austin, Texas, and much, much more, you can find that all on my website at drmarakarpel.com. And you can hear all of the previous programs that we have done with Blog Talk Radio by going, again, directly to Blog Talk Radio, blogtalkradio.com/yourgoldenyears. And be sure to follow me on Facebook for all the latest updates, Dr. Mara Karpel, Your Golden Years. And my newest Facebook page is about my book, and that's Passionate Life by Dr. Mara Karpel. And if this is the first time that you're tuning in, I'm a licensed psychologist from New York City practicing here in Austin, Texas, and in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas. And I work with adults of all ages and have a specialty of working with seniors and caregivers. And for the past few years, have also been evaluating veterans for PTSD. And part of the time, my office is in the really great Veterans Resource Center, Heroes Night Out, which is located in Cedar Park, Texas. And for information about this wonderful resource for veterans and for veterans' families, you can check out their website, heroesnightout.org. And if you want to contact me with any questions or comments or information that you think that I should know about, feel free to send me an email to Dr. Mara at drmarakarpel.com or go through my website or give me a call at 512-626-6973. This evening's program is produced by Accomplice Entertainment, Postal Productions, and Spiked Up Productions, and sponsored by Dr. Ronald DeVere, neurologist, memory specialist, and author of the book, Memory Loss, Everything You Want to Know But Forget to Ask. Dr. DeVere at his memory clinic in Lakeway, Texas, or to purchase a copy of his book, you can give him a call at 512-261-7909 or send him an email to rdevere, that's rdevere, at austin.rr.com. And his book is also available on Amazon. And this evening's program is also sponsored by StoryHouse. StoryHouse gathers your stories and turns them into multimedia collections that can be shared now and for generations to come. Have StoryHouse over to conduct a private interview in your home or invite them to your next big event or family reunion. StoryHouse, where your memories live. Find out more at yourstoryhouse.com or call 512-296-8752. Okay, we're going to take a brief break and play a few of our sponsors' commercials. But don't go anywhere, because when we come back, we'll be joined on the phone by Rabbi Naomi Levy to talk about her latest book, Einstein and the Rabbi. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Go.
Super psychologist Dr. Mara Karpel will be back after words from our sponsors.
About memory loss? Dr. Ronald DeVere, certified neurologist and director of Alzheimer's disease and memory disorders in Lakeway, has been helping those with dementia and memory loss for over 12 years, specializing in the diagnosis, treatment, and counseling of those with memory loss and dementia. Dr. DeVere also has a book to reduce your worry and fear by knowing the fact. Memory Loss, Everything You Want to Know But Forget to Ask, available now on Amazon.com. Dr. Ronald DeVere, Alzheimer's Disease and Memory Disorders Center in Lakeway, and his book, Memory Loss, Everything You Want to Know But Forget to Ask. For more information or to schedule an appointment, call 512-261-7909.
Are you or a loved one a Medicare beneficiary? Help save you and Medicare money by stopping Medicare fraud. Fraud happens when Medicare is billed for services or supplies you never receive. There are three easy things you can do to fight fraud. Review your Medicare claims for accuracy, protect your personal information, and be on the lookout for suspicious activity. For more information or to report fraud, call Medicare at 1-800-MEDICARE or your local SHIP counselor at the Area Agency on Aging at 1-800-252-9240.
Please visit us on the web at www.drmarakarpel.com.
And we're back. If you're just joining us, this is Dr. Mara Karpel and Your Golden Years on blogtalkradio.com and on drmarakarpel.com. And joining us, California, we have the best-selling author Naomi Levy joining us to talk about her latest book, Einstein and the Rabbi. Good evening, Naomi, or good afternoon.
Hello, Mara. It's nice to speak with you.
It's very nice to speak with you. And I just want to let you know that when we speak like this, there's a slight delay. Just, you know, sometimes
okay.
It trips people up if they don't know. So Naomi, I'm very excited to have you on the program. And I absolutely loved your book. But before we get into talking about the book, maybe you can tell our listeners a little bit about your background.
What would you like to know?
I know that you were one of the first women who studied in rabbinical school. So maybe you can talk just a little bit about that.
I grew up in Brooklyn, New York. And from the youngest age, I wanted to become a rabbi. From about age 4, I knew I wanted to become a rabbi. And everybody laughed and everybody thought this was the craziest idea. Or some people even scolded me, telling me that, don't you know, girls can't be rabbis. But I was very blessed to be actually in the very first class of women to enter the rabbinical seminary at the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York. And I was also the very first female conservative rabbi to head up a congregation on the West Coast.
Right. And now, aren't you the founder of an organization?
Yes, I'm the founder of an organization based in L.A. called Nashuva. And we reach out to Jews all over the world who sort of bring spirituality and energy back into Jewish life. And we do live webcasts and we do all sorts of social justice and social action projects locally in LA.
Very nice. Very nice.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been on Oprah. So that's a big deal.
I've been on Oprah and I've been on the Today Show. I've been on the Talk. Yeah,
that's all very exciting.
Yeah.
So, when I heard about your book, I was really interested to read the book, and I know the story of the rabbi that you found and found out about, and that spurred your book. But I also, as I was reading, I realized that the lessons that you share with us, the readers, as you were learning them along the way about listening to your soul's calling, is so much in alignment with, what I talk about on this show and things, everything that I've written. And I found myself reading one chapter at a time so that I could take the time to digest each lesson, because there was so much in there. It's really such a packed book. and I guess it would be really interesting, and I know it's in the book as well, and readers, listeners can read the book and get to know more about it, but maybe you could talk a little bit about what led you on this journey that ended up in writing this book.
Well, I was actually just doing research about human interconnectedness and the ways that we're really all just one. And I came upon a quote by Einstein that just took my breath away. And I'll just read to you a little bit of it. A human being is part of the whole, called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separate from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. And I just kept reading that over and over again. A human being is part of a whole. We call it universe. We may see ourselves as separate, but it's merely an optical delusion. And Einstein's words just stopped me in my tracks, because they so embodied everything that I've come to understand about my life and about this world. And then I saw, as I kept looking elsewhere, about this quote, just in parenthesis somewhere, it would say, Einstein wrote this to a grieving father. And for some reason, I was drawn to just that little footnote, to that little asterisk. I needed to know who Einstein was talking to and what had elicited this beautiful statement. And I kept researching it, and I learned that he had spoken it to somebody named Dr. Robert Marcus. I did a little bit more research, and I learned that it was a rabbi, actually, Rabbi Robert Marcus, and that he had lost a child, and that Einstein was writing a letter of condolence. These words were a letter of condolence to someone named Rabbi Robert Marcus who had lost a child. And I just became fascinated. I needed to know who was this man named Rabbi Robert Marcus, because as you know, as a therapist and me as a rabbi, so many people come to us with their life problems, but who do we go to? Who does a rabbi go to with his problems or her problems? And why would this rabbi turn to Albert Einstein for help? And I learned about this man, Rabbi Robert Marcus, who actually wasn't just some man who was a footnote in history, some little asterisk beneath Einstein's letter, but he was truly a remarkable man who was a chaplain during World War II and was one of the very first to help liberate the Buchenwald concentration camp. Concentration camp, he discovered close to 1,000 Jewish boys who were alive. And one of those boys was a young teenage kid who looked more dead than alive named Eliezer. But we all know who he is, and the world has come to know him as Elie Wiesel of blessed memory.
Mm-hmm.
And Rabbi Marcus took it upon himself to be really the father and the mother and the rabbi to these orphaned children. And when the war was over, he dedicated his life to causes of justice, and while he was away fighting for better rights for Europe's remaining Jews, his own little son, Jay, died of polio.
Mm-hmm.
And this man who had spent so much time saving and preserving and uplifting the lives of children couldn't protect his own precious child. And it was in that anguish that he writes to Einstein and receives these words of consolation and of wisdom. And the rest of my book really is a meditation on what part of us can see the way Einstein is describing, what part of us enables us to see the commonality in all things, to see the way we're all interconnected. And I believe it's the soul.
Mm-hmm. Mhm. Yeah, it's just so powerful, and you know, and that, and of course the story of Rabbi Marcus is incredible.
Yes. Yeah.
So how did discovering story, you know, influence your own life? I know you became kind of obsessed with this and finding out more as much as you could.
Yes. I think both the selflessness of Rabbi Marcus and his outspoken commitment to justice affected me deeply. And his sacrifices for the sake of others affected me very deeply. And Einstein's words to him, his assurance to him that everything is united, that everything is one, it just sort of led me on a multi-year meditation on ways that we ignore this truth and we dismiss it or take it for granted, and what we can do to raise the volume of the soul's voice in our lives so that we can actually hear what it's trying to teach us. And as a rabbi, and I speak often to therapists about this, that so often people come for help with what they think are life questions. What should I do with my life? Who is my soulmate? Is this the right person for me? And I really find that so many so-called life questions are actually soul questions. And that the answer that we're seeking actually lies within us. That there is a voice of knowledge and a voice of wisdom that can help us turn work into calling, that can help us find the soulmate we've been seeking, that can help us rekindle relationships, that can help us parent in ways of wisdom and recognize what true soul parenting is all about.
Yeah. You know, I talk a lot about, and my book that is coming out is all about, you know, finding your passion and following your passion. Mm-hmm. And when I read your, when I read what you wrote about following your soul and finding what your soul is saying to you, it kind of hit me like, wow, it's much deeper. It goes much deeper than, you know, passion is really just a description of, you know, the soul's calling.
I believe that within us, you know, we live in a time where there are so many voices shouting at us. There are voices from the outside telling us what we ought to be, what we should be, what beauty is, what success looks like. And so often we bend ourselves or we contort ourselves to try to measure up to things that aren't actually true to us. And there are even voices within us that shout at us, the voice of the ego and its vanities and its ambitions, the voice of the body and its desires. But there's one voice inside of us that knows us intimately. But the problem is it speaks in whispers.
Mm-hmm.
And the challenge of life is to learn to hear what it's trying to tell us. And the challenge in life is to somehow find a way to lower the volume of those other voices and to raise the volume of our soul's voice, a voice that knows why we were put here, a voice that knows about our calling, a voice that understands that every day of life is calling to us with a mission. And so often we miss it. We're so busy reaching after things that aren't actually true to ourselves. We miss it.
So, you know, what would you say to people who say, but, you know, I know what I really want to do and I feel like this is my the path I want to take, but I can't do it because I have this, I have life responsibilities and I just can't. There's no way for me to do it, or I don't have the money, or I don't have the time.
I think that every day is an opportunity to take a tiny step. It doesn't have to be a giant quantum leap, but a tiny step in the direction of what you feel internally is calling to you. And so often people will come to me and say, I realize I don't do enough of what I love. And it doesn't even have to be some grand scheme. It's that I really love playing guitar, but I stopped playing because people told me I wasn't good enough.
Mm-hmm.
I love drawing, and I stopped drawing because people told me I didn't have talent. I love singing, and I stopped singing because people told me I'm tone deaf.
Mm-hmm.
There are ways to reincorporate the things that bring us joy into our lives without having to believe that it's necessarily that I'm going to be a concert pianist or a famous guitarist or a world famous opera singer, to realize that we allow children to experience and to express so many sides of themselves, and then we shut them down. And there are pieces of ourselves that we need to reawaken and to realize that we're only whole when we welcome all the pieces of ourselves. And also that sometimes we denigrate the very things that bring us joy. I tell a story in the book about a man who draws blood. He's a phlebotomist. And he said to me, I always thought I was going to be a basketball star. And I said, what you're doing right now is so great. Can you see that? And he said, yes, thank the Lord that I was able to see that. Sometimes what we desire actually runs against the very grain of our souls, but we seek it anyway because the world tells us that's what success looks like.
So sometimes,
and often as parents,
you know,
as parents, we do the same thing. We raise children hoping that they will fulfill our dreams and our wishes, instead of raising them and understanding that they're not carbon copies of us, nor are they there to fulfill our dreams. That it's our responsibility to help nurture their souls, for them to become who they were born to be.
I was kind of laughing when you talked about the singing, because that was, you know, I always wanted to be able to sing. I can play a musical instrument, but I couldn't sing in key for some reason.
Yeah.
And I actually had a dream about it. I dreamt that somebody taught me how to sing in key, and that when I did that, it was like the obstacles on my path of life just came crumbling down. And it wasn't that I wanted to be a singer. It was just like it opened something up for me. And it was just it was like within a couple of weeks that I met a singing teacher. She was actually on this program. She said, I love teaching people to sing who feel like they sing out of key. Why don't you let me help you?
See?
And it was amazing. I'm not going to perform in front of anybody. But I
That's
feel
not the
good.
Point.
That,
yeah. That's not the point. The point is to welcome in those banished pieces of ourselves that bring us wholeness and joy. And I speak in the book about a meditation based on a Hebrew word called husa. And I talk about when I try to describe this mantra, husa, I say to my students, to my meditation students, I say, you remember that pot holder that you made in kindergarten on the loom, over, under, over, under? And you brought it home and it was all lopsided. It was just lopsided, and it might have been strings hanging out here and there, but your mother proudly hung it on the fridge. And the husa meditation is that your mother loved it or your father loved it, not because it was perfect, but precisely because it was lopsided, because it reflected somehow the beauty of you trying. The beauty of imperfection, and that's what the Hebrew word husa means. It's a love and it's a compassion. It's a compassion for something because of its imperfection, which is how it's actually the love of God, how it's described to us, that grace isn't the love that God has because we're perfect. Grace is the love that God has for us precisely because we're wanting, precisely because we're imperfect. And it's the love that we can have for ourselves, precisely because our bodies aren't perfect, because our noses aren't necessarily straight, because we're showing wrinkles as you're speaking of aging, right? Precisely to love ourselves in that process, in our imperfection, to learn to love others that way, to learn to love your child that way, and your spouse that way, and your friends that way, and your parents that way, and your siblings that way, and your coworkers too. If we seek perfection in others or in ourselves, you know what? We're going to end up being very angry and resentful people,
mm-hmm.
self-hating mm-hmm. and judgmental. But if we can have a little husa, which is a love of someone with their imperfections, not despite them, but in their imperfection, what a different world and what a different life we will lead.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That, I mean, when you say what a different world, you know, we could all use that right now.
Yes,
and
we
that
can.
Would really heal the world.
100%.
So, you know, actually that chapter on Husa is the one that is most dog-eared in the book, in my copy of your book.
Yes.
And in that chapter, you wrote something really interesting. I want to ask you about that. You wrote
mm-hmm.
that the journey of following your soul's calling
mm-hmm.
and the art of remaining on the path even when the road is inhospitable.
Mm-hmm.
And you said that when it seems as if you've made no progress at all, and that even staying on the road when it seems like you've made no progress at all, but also how the feeling of having arrived or attaining enlightenment or even peace of mind is a false goal, and that we should be aware of that. So,
yeah.
What does that mean? I mean, I was taken aback.
I think that, yeah, I think that often one of the reasons that people don't have a meeting with their souls is because they mistakenly think that meeting your soul will lead to bliss, that having a soulful experience is equivalent to nirvana or some kind of blissful state, peace of mind. And what I say in the book is actually living with can keep you up at night. It can actually
mm-hmm.
keep you up at night because the soul doesn't deal in bliss. It deals in open eyes. And open eyes are eyes that notice somebody who's sleeping on the street. Open eyes are eyes that notice what's broken in this beautiful, broken world.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime someone says those words, I've arrived, I say in the book, that's a person who's lost his or her way. Because the soul is always seeking growth and learning. And if you think that you can just lay on the couch with your feet up,
uh-huh.
my work is done, then you haven't actually understood where your soul is at.
Hmm.
Because there's not a day that isn't an opportunity to help someone or to learn something.
Mm.
Every day has its purpose. Every moment of life has its purpose. And particularly when we're speaking of aging, since that was, I was listening to your prior words before I came on your show,
mm-hmm.
there's not an age in life when we're not continuing to grow. There's not a period in life when we're not continuing to grow, when we don't have the opportunity to give, to receive, and to learn. And there isn't an hour in a day that we don't have the occasion to learn, to grow, and to give. And anytime we feel my work is done, or I'm washed up, or I've arrived, you can be sure that you've lost your way.
Hmm. That's interesting. I like that because actually there's a lot of excitement in growing and learning and right? It actually gives you purpose.
Exactly. Exactly. Precisely. And it's
mm-hmm.
not a harsh thing. What I'm saying is not a harsh thing. It's not you can never have rest. I'm not saying that. It's not that you can never have rest in your life or you can never feel good about yourself. It's that there's always more to do, and there's always more ways to give and to grow.
Right. And, you know, if we're awake, we can see that even when things are going well in our life, that there are other people who could use our help in the world. So, yeah. So,
and that, so there are always new things to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, sure, we make false assumptions about our own capacities to grow. You know, we think once we reach a certain point in life that we're fully formed. We're not. We're not. And it's not just a challenge. It's actually just a wonderful idea that actually scientists are learning more and more about how our brain continues to create new cells throughout life, into the end of life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's always something that we can do for other people, even right up to the end of our life.
Yes.
So, you know, I know there's your whole book has all kinds of suggestions, but just if you could give a suggestion for listeners who might not be able to hear, they don't know their own soul calling, they just don't know where to go, what to do, what can they do to be able to hear that whisper of their soul?
Well, one thing is very simple, to just go alone into the woods or to the beach, someplace in nature. I tell a tiny little parable there of a little boy who goes into the woods every day. And his father notices that his son keeps going into the woods. And he asks his son, he said, "Son, why do you keep going into the woods?" And the boy says, "I go there to find God." And the father gently tries to correct his son. And he says to his son, "My child, don't you know God is the same everywhere?" And the little boy looks at his father and he says, "Yes, Papa, but I'm not the same everywhere." And we're not the same everywhere. We may think we are, but we're not. And it's important to put ourselves in situations that give us the strength to actually hear what's really going on inside of us. It's as simple as just taking a walk alone in nature and to really just be still enough to hear. I talk in the book about how meeting your soul, you can envision it as trying to meet a deer in the woods. How quiet you have to be. How still to have that kind of communion with another. And your soul is there. You have to be still enough to actually hear it and listen and understand what it's trying to say to you.
And, you know, I think I just want to make a comment that I think is really, really important. I have found as a therapist for people to do just that, because I think that the most depression and anxiety that I see is related to people completely ignoring their soul's calling.
And you know, I think we're living in a time when the invasion of work into home life, or the invasion of our smartphones, of Instagram and Facebook and Snapchat and Twitter into our lives, is such that we no longer even have, we don't permit ourselves even a moment of quiet, because even in those moments, we're thumbing through our phones. And how important it is to just make time for stillness and to see what's there.
Yeah. That thank you so much for talking about that, because that's really, you know, something that I'm always trying to talk about with my own clients, and you know, and I have to remind myself. So
yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you were saying follow me on this page and that page and the other page. And,
yes.
You know, here I am, you know, my publisher would like me to post here and there in the other place.
Yes.
But that stuff, and I think we're all aware of it, it can actually take over your life to the point where you don't have space to create or
mm-hmm.
to think or to be true to yourself. We need that space.
Mm-hmm.
We need it.
I agree. And I think that, you know, as you said, you know, without the internet, I wouldn't have the program, right? Because we're on
right.
the internet.
Of course. Go on.
Well, I was going to say, there's so many positive things, but you have to be able to step away from it for a while, and I know I do, or I start to become overwhelmed.
Yeah.
So, that time has gone by so quickly. There's so much
mm-hmm.
to talk
mm-hmm.
about, but I really encourage listeners to read the book, because it's not just an interesting story, but it's really a meditation, as you said, and it has a lot in it for people to do and to think about, that I find really, really powerful. So how can people, you know, find out more about you and your book and also
mm-hmm.
purchase this book?
Mm-hmm. The Neshuvah community that I'm the spiritual leader of, that website is neshuvah.com. There's also a website just about my books called RabbiNaomiLevy.com. Readers can, or listeners can, always email me at RabbiNaomiLevy@gmail.com. And yes, you can find me on Facebook as Rabbi Naomi Levy, and you can find me on Instagram. I also appear there as Rabbi Naomi Levy.
Okay. Well, that just makes it easy. Very consistent.
Yes. That's who I am.
Yeah. I want to thank you so much for coming on this program. I really, really enjoyed speaking with you. And I wanted to let you know that next week, the daughter of Rabbi Robert Marcus is going to be on the program, who you spoke about in the book, Roberta Marcus Liner.
Oh, wonderful. Roberta Liner. And I did want to say one other thing, if possible. This week, April 11th, is the anniversary of the liberation of Buchenwald. That Rabbi Marcus, the day that Rabbi Marcus was there to help liberate Buchenwald, and that evening, at April 11th at night and April 12th, is Yom HaShoah. It's Holocaust Memorial Day. So I certainly am thinking, and Rabbi Marcus's memory is very burning very brightly this week, and the incredible work that he did. And I'm so grateful to Roberta Liner, Marcus Liner, and to her sister, Dr. Tamara Green, who opened up their memories, their stories, and their precious legacy with me to make it possible for me to write this book with their help.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a pretty incredible story, and I will post those dates on my web post along with the website links that you gave me, so that
mm-hmm.
people
thank you
can actually see it when they just go to my website later.
Wonderful.
So thank you so much again, and
thank you.
You know, I look forward to reading some of your other books.
I'm honored. I look forward to reading your book.
Thank you. I'm honored. That'll be out.
Great. And I just wish you only success.
Thank
you. I'm looking forward to it. Okay.
Thanks. I'll let you know when it's out. All
Please.
Right.
Okay.
You have a good evening. All right.
Thank you.
You.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, so we're going to take a break, and we have a lot more to come, so don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Are you or a loved one a Medicare beneficiary? Help save you and Medicare money by stopping Medicare fraud. Fraud happens when Medicare is billed for services or supplies you never receive. There are three easy things you can do to fight fraud. Review your Medicare claims for accuracy, protect your personal information, and be on the lookout for suspicious activity. For more information or to report fraud, call Medicare at 1-800-MEDICARE or your local SHIP counselor at the Area Agency on Aging at 1-800-252-9240.
Worried about memory loss? Dr. Ronald DeVere, certified neurologist and director of Alzheimer's disease and memory disorders in Lakeway, has been helping those with dementia and memory loss for over 12 years, specializing in the diagnosis, treatment, and counseling of those with memory loss and dementia. Dr. DeVere also has a book to reduce your worry and fear by knowing the fact. Memory loss, everything you want to know but forget to ask, available now on Amazon.com. Dr. Ronald DeVere, Alzheimer's disease and memory disorders center in Lakeway, and his book, Memory Loss, everything you want to know but forget to ask. For more information or to schedule an appointment, call 512-261-7909.
Please visit us on the web at www.drmaricarpell.com.
And we're back. If you're just joining us, this is Dr. Mara Carpell and your golden years right here on blogtalkradio.com and on drmaracarpell.com. And that's a hard interview to follow, but I am going to follow it. I picked a topic that I think kind of dovetails with that discussion, and it's about optimism and realistic optimism and why it's good for your health. So I think one of the ways of becoming an optimist is focusing your attention on your soul's calling and just keep going on the path. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit more in a moment, and then afterwards we'll be joined by bass player Kim Sessions, who's right here in Austin, Texas, and we're going to be playing some of her original music. So, but just first, let me give you the news. And as I mentioned, my book is coming out. And if you haven't heard it here or read it on Facebook, I am actually now working with a publisher, and the ebook will be available on Amazon this summer. And that's what's called the soft launch, and it'll be available at a discounted price if you buy it this summer. So I'll let you know when that's available, so you can go out and purchase it, because that'll be the best price. And then the hard launch, which is when the printed copies will be available from Amazon and all of your favorite booksellers. Will be in October 2018. So stay tuned for more news about that. And the name of that book is The Passionate Life, Creating Vitality and Joy at Any Age. So we'll keep you updated on that. And I do have another blog coming out. I kind of missed the month of March with a blog in thriveglobal.com. That's Arianna Huffington's online health and wellness magazine. I usually publish monthly, but with the signing with a publisher, as as Rabbi Levy alluded to, that suddenly it becomes really busy when you are publishing a book. So there were a lot of things that they're requiring, and time got away from me. So I do promise you there is another blog coming out this month, and there is another tip for caregivers that will be coming out very shortly, and that is the tips for caregivers near and far. And let's see. Oh, if you haven't checked it out yet, I do have a meditation that you can download from my website, and it's free. and it's a meditation for inner peace, joy, and vitality, and I'm guiding you through it. And just go to my website, drmaricarpel.com. It should pop up, and all you have to do is put in your email, and you'll get an instant email back with the link to the MP3. And if it doesn't pop up on my website, then go to the page that says free meditation. And, so, let me know what you think about that. And as I mentioned, we have some videos on YouTube of people that come into the studio to do the interview right here in Austin, Texas. And you can see those on my website just by clicking on videos, or go to YouTube and search for my name, and you should be able to find those YouTube videos there. And I think that's it for the news for now. That's a lot, so I'll keep you updated on that. So I want to talk about optimism. Recently, 2 weeks ago, I was invited to give a talk to the Austin Area Home Health Council. And they requested that, I gave them a list of things that I could speak about, and they requested that I speak about optimism because, they are dealing with a lot of, in home health, they're dealing with a lot of people who are feeling sad or anxious about having to have some health care, have a home health aid, or some of them are work in facilities and senior facilities, and so they wanted to know how to be more optimistic, or why they even need to be more optimistic. So I want to talk about what I spoke about with them. And very often when people talk about optimism, they show you a glass that's half filled with liquid, and we'll say, is this glass half empty or is it half full? And the truth of it is that it's both. It is half empty and it is half full. And it's how you perceive that glass, whether it's half empty or half full, that kind of reflects on your past, your optimism or pessimism. And some people tend to think that pessimism is just being more realistic. But the truth is that everything has both a positive and negative side to it. So if you focus only on the negative and you're a pessimist, then you're not really any more realistic than somebody who only focuses on the positive and is always optimistic. And I do want to talk about being a realistic optimist, because being overly optimistic can also be kind of dangerous, both health-wise and emotionally, can lead to running into brick walls. But being a realistic optimist is not the same as being a pessimist. All right. Let me tell you some of the reasons that pessimism is not so good for you. The research in psychology has found that depression actually stems from a pessimistic mindset. So the things that we say to ourselves affect how we feel. And if we're always saying negative things and always expecting a negative outcome and always looking at the dark side of a situation, then that is what is called a pessimist, and that will lead to depression. And in fact, there was a famous study by Dr. Martin Seligman. When I was back in undergraduate school for psychology, we studied Dr. Martin Seligman's study of learned helplessness. And in this study, he would have, I don't think this study would be allowed these days with all the strict restrictions on testing with animals, but back then, I think this was done in the 70s, that they allowed it. The findings were really interesting. So they had a pen where some dogs were in the pen, and they would receive low-level shocks from the floor of the pen. So every time they stepped down on the floor, they would get a little, nothing dangerous, but they'd get a little zap. And there was no way for them to avoid it. There was no way to get out of the pen. No matter what they did, they got a little zap to their feet. And then they put those dogs in another pen. And in that pen, half of the floor was electrified, where they got those little zaps to their feet, and the other half was not. So that if you were walking on the other side of the pen, you would not be shocked. And there was a little wall in between that a dog could, if they really wanted to, they could jump over the wall and get to the other side. So if you were in the part of the pen that had the shocks, you could jump over the wall easily as a dog. The dog could jump over the wall easily and then be on the side where they had relief, where they didn't have the shock. And they had the group of dogs who had been shocked and couldn't get out, and they had another group of dogs who had not been in that pen that had shocks. They were considered what experiment is referred to as naive, meaning that they never were exposed to shocks at all. And what they found was that the group of dogs who had previously been unable to get away from the shock, when they got shocked in this new pen, they did nothing to climb over the wall. They did not jump over the wall to get relief. They just stayed on the part of the pen that continued to shock them. And the group of dogs, now dogs are naturally optimistic. The group of dogs that had not been in the pen with the shocks, when they were put in the pen with the side of the shocks, they all jumped over the wall and got to the side of relief. And what Dr. Seligman concluded was that the dogs had learned to be helpless, the ones that had received no relief. They had learned to be helpless. They had turned into pessimists. And then he extended this, he generalized it to humans and did research to show that people who are depressed very often are people who feel helpless and hopeless and unable to change the situation that they're in. Even they are then put in another situation where they really can change the situation, where they do have the power, they remain pessimists. And they remain depressed. So depression has a lot of negative consequences to our health. Depression, pessimism and depression can cause a weakened immune system, which leads to a greater risk of becoming sick. Pessimists are less likely to seek medical advice when they're ill, or to follow recommended regimens of diet and exercise because they feel like, you know, they're pessimistic. What's the point? Nothing really matters anyway, or I'm going to die anyway, so why do what it takes to be healthy? Pessimists are also found to be less resilient after a negative life event. In fact, they found that people who were pessimistic were more likely to die within the first 6 months following the death of their spouse, while that did not happen to people who were optimistic. And pessimists are less likely to seek help, less likely to seek social support, and they're more likely to be isolated. And isolation leads to depression. So that's another, then you kind of spiral down. So pessimism leads to depression, which leads to more pessimism, which leads to more depression. It's a negative spiral, and it's all controlled by how we view the world. While a positive attitude can actually lead to a happier and healthier life. So optimism, opposite from pessimism, tends to boost our immune system and helps us to fend off chronic diseases. So even if being optimistic is unrealistic, we actually, it becomes realistic. There have been so many stories that I'm sure you've heard of, stories of people who had miracle recoveries from diseases where they were told that they would never recover. But those people tended to be optimistic. They just wouldn't have it that this disease was going to kill them, and they ended up overcoming the disease, and the doctors could tell you no reason why they overcame it other than their positive attitude. So a realistic optimist is someone who knows that there's no guarantee that having a positive attitude is going to cure you from illness, but you're more likely to overcome your illness if you're more positive. Also, in a more direct way, optimists are more likely to stick to healthy diet and exercise regimens, and they're willing to go seek medical advice when they need it. So they tend to be healthier for that reason, because they believe that it will work, you know, that it really makes a difference about what you eat or how much you exercise and if you do what the doctor tells you to do. And it's actually been documented that people with a positive attitude about aging, those people who feel really good about aging, tend to live on average 7.5 years longer than they're happier and healthier than those with a negative view of growing older. So just feeling positive about aging can lead to a longer life. And, what is realistic optimism? So realistic optimism would be that, for example, let's say I'll give a low-level example. So let's say you're taking a test, and you're in school, you're taking a test. We've all been through this, and a topic that is kind of difficult for us. It doesn't come naturally. Maybe, you know, some people find mathematics very difficult, and they have a test coming up, and it's not an easy topic for them. So a pessimist would say, well, I'm no good at it. There's no point in studying, and, you know, I'm just going to fail. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. They're more likely to fail because they didn't study. Or they did study, but they went with a pessimistic attitude and became very anxious and blanked out during the test, again, causing them to fail. An unrealistic optimist might say, well, I'm so good at everything, I'm gonna ace this test, and I don't even have to study. Chances are they're going to fail that test because it's not a topic that came naturally to them, and they didn't study. They didn't do the work that required in order to pass the test. A realistic optimist would say, I believe that I have the ability to do what it takes to pass this test. I'm going to study really hard, and I believe that if I study really hard, there's a good chance that I'll pass the test. And if I don't pass the test, even after studying really hard, then maybe I need to get some help. Maybe I need a tutor in the future, or in order to be able to do better the next time. Or maybe it means that I'm in a class that's a little bit too difficult for me, and I need to rethink my major, or I need to maybe take another prerequisite so that I can do better in the test next time. So basically, it's not that I can pass anything without trying, but I have the ability to do whatever it's in order to do better, or to rethink my path in life and that doesn't require something that I'm really going to have a very hard time with. So And I know that I'm going to survive even if I fail. That's another really important part of it, that it's not the end of the world if I fail. So that's another part of being a realistic optimist. And with regard to health, it might mean that, hey, I have this funny-looking spot on my arm. A pessimist might say, well, what's the point of checking it out? I'm going to die anyway. A realistic optimist might say, well, gee, if I go to the doctor and they check it out and it turns out to be something, you know, that I need treatment for, then it's better for me to go to the doctor now and get early treatment so that before something, it turns into something worse. And they're more likely to go and get the help that they need to prevent them from it turning into a really negative situation. So I was asked at this workshop, at this talk that I gave, you know, well, how do you become an optimist? What if you're not born that way? What if your parents are negative and you've been brought up in a worrying, negative, pessimistic environment? And the answer to that is really most of us are not born optimists. I know very few people who are just so happy about everything all the time and didn't have to work to become that way. Most of us have to work at it. And it is I am very optimistic about the outcome of that we really do have the skills to be able to work at it. So the same doctor who wrote, same psychologist who wrote about learned helplessness also later wrote a book when he got into more positive psychology. Dr. Martin Seligman wrote the book Learned Optimism. And what he found is that people absolutely learn to be optimists and can actually change the structure of their brain. So like Rabbi Levy was talking about how even as we get older, even till the very end of life, we grow new neurons and we can actually change our brain. That works with every, you know, throughout our life, we can change the way that we see things and we can actually change the structure of our brain. And neuropsychologists refer to that as having neuroplasticity, that our brains are flexible and can develop new neural pathways. So the way that we can develop new neural pathways so that we have an optimistic, positive reaction to things is through practice. It's changing habits. And one of the things that the main things that we need to change is the way that we think. So we need to become more aware of our thoughts. And we can use how we feel as a gauge. If we feel bad about something, we can notice, hey, I'm feeling really bad. What am I saying to myself to make myself feel bad? And we can look at our thoughts and decide, is this really rational? Is it really logical? Dr. Albert Ellis founded rationally motivated behavior therapy, and that was one of the things that he would have his clients do. And he writes about this in like all of his 100 and something books that he wrote, that we can challenge our thoughts, that most of the time people worry about worst case scenarios, but they never actually think about what are the chances of that worst case scenario happening. Usually it's pretty low. And secondly, even if it happened, now let's take it further, how can we be prepared for it so that it's not the end of the world? Most of the time, worst case scenarios are not the end of the world. So if we look at how we think and we combine a positive attitude that we can turn it around and say, you know what? I can do this, or this isn't going to be bad. It's going to turn out well, with an honest evaluation of the challenges that we meet along the path. Think about what we're trying to achieve. Think about what steps we need to take to achieve them and to overcome challenges, and be able to tell ourselves that, you know, we have the ability to do more than what we have, you know, always assumed that we can do. If we expect the unexpected and know that we have the tools to overcome even unexpected challenges, that would help us to be a realistic optimist. And, you know, to overcome the habit of being a pessimist, Seligman recommends don't obsess about unpleasant events. If something unpleasant has occurred, before you spend time thinking about it, do something to get yourself into a better feeling state. Do something you enjoy and then come back to the problem with the goal of coming up with a plan to improve the situation. There's a technique called thought stopping, where if you tend to be obsessive about negative things, wear a rubber band around your wrist, and whenever you notice you're having a repetitive negative thought, snap the rubber band and let that be a signal to change your thoughts to more positive ones. It will literally snap you out of it. And ask yourself, when you have a negative thought, where is the evidence that this is true? And look for an alternative explanation rather than assuming the worst. Exercise, I always talk about exercise, causes your brain to release endorphins, which are those natural pain relievers and mood elevators that can naturally turn your thoughts to more positive thoughts. Eat better food and get more sleep. These will help you to be more positive. And finally, make it a point to laugh every day, because laughter will immediately change your perception of things. And I said that's final, but there actually is one more thing, and that is have an attitude of gratitude. And just think of 5 things every day, even if they're really small, that you feel grateful for, and write it down. And the research findings are people who do that every day actually change their brain, and it changes your mood and your whole way of seeing the world. So with that, I'm going to take the break. We're going to take a brief break, and then we're going to come back with basis session, and we're going to be playing some music of the bass players that influenced Kim Session to come up with her music and the way that she plays. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Good evening, everybody. I'd like to say hello to my mother. Thank you.
All right, and we are back. If you're just joining us, this is Dr. Mara Karpel in your golden years on blogtalkradio.com and on drmarakarpel.com. And now we were just listening to some of the music of Jaco Pastorius, who is one of the influences of our next guest, who's joining us on the phone, bassist Kim Session. Good evening, Kim. Are you there?
I am here.
Hi there.
Thank you, Mara, for having me.
Thank you. I just want to let you know that when we speak like this, there's a slight delay. So sometimes it trips people up if they don't know it's there.
Okay. I'll count until I answer.
So Kim, are you here in Austin?
I am close by. I actually live in Dripping Springs.
Oh, okay. All right. And thank you so much for coming on the program. Can you tell us a little bit about your musical history?
Sure. I would say I'm primarily a pretty late bloomer with music. I did a little bit of drumming when I was in grade school. My stepfather that raised me was a championship snare drummer, so I was kind of, you know, influenced by him and that passion. And, you know, to this day, I still love the drums. I mean, there was a point before I became pregnant that I was going to throw the bass away and just get going on the drums, because there's so much more fun, to be honest. But
mm-hmm.
I'd always just worked in musical fields. When I was in college, I was a DJ at the college radio station. I had a punk rock show called Blah, Blah, Blah that was kind of influenced by Iggy Pop. And I played a lot of the popular kind of punk music at that time, like Husker Du and Firehose and Bowie and whatever else was going on at the time. And, you know, all in high school, I was very involved with kids that loved music. That was our passion. We weren't necessarily in the band, but we loved to go see shows, and any shows that our parents would let us to go see, that was our livelihood. So when I was in college, one of my best friends was a blues bass player from Chicago, and he played with a band in Chicago called Eddie Clearwater. And Eddie Clearwater was a African-American man, and he was sort of famous for wearing this big Indian headdress. And my friend Scott Meyer was his bass player, and he had moved back to Arizona, where we were both going to school at Arizona State University. And we studied together, and we always made good grades and kind of had a good, you know, friendship going. And one day he said, why don't you play an instrument? You're so involved with music, you'd probably be pretty decent. Why don't you give something a shot? And so I was like, well, okay, like what? And he was like, well, like the bass, duh. So I took him up on it, and I did a couple of lessons with him. And I was about 19 years old at this time. And you know, Scott was a great friend and all, but as far as being my teacher, that was not going to work. I mean, he had me doing like the most complicated, you know, things you could study in the first two lessons before I even knew how to work my fingers. So it was like, I love you, but, you know, this is not going to work. So I lugged the bass around with me for another, you know, 10 years or 9 years or so. And then finally, it just got to be time, like, okay, am I going to do this or not do this? And I was living in Los Angeles at that time, and I decided, well, I'm going to do this. So I called, I got in the back page of BAM magazine. That was really popular at the time, and that's where people would put their ads that were looking for bands or musicians or teachers looking to get students. So there was a guy in the back of it that sounded good enough, and so I called him. And it was just like a magical combination. He was an Italian guy that had gotten a scholarship to Berkeley and was actually a film composer major. But his first instrument was the bass. And he was just the most patient, kind, organized, methodical teacher. And I went under his wing for probably about 2 years and kind of started playing out really before I was even ready, which, you know, sometimes you've got to do. You just got to take that plunge, as scary as it is. And mm-hmm. so my first foray into the, you know, professional musical performance world was on the Sunset Strip, you know, playing with kind of glam rock bands where the boys were prettier than I was. And, uh-huh. you know, going up and down the Sunset Strip and doing that thing for a little bit. And then I kind of got, you know, interested more and more in the blues. I sort of discovered, well, this music is cool and I love it and I love punk and I'm really open-minded about music, but there's one music that I never, ever get tired. I never need a break from, and that's the blues. And so at that point was kind of when I first started to discover that maybe that's what I want to go into. I worked at a recording studio in Los Angeles for a few years, and I also worked at a restaurant that maybe some people might recognize that are listening, called At My Place. I was a waitress there, and it was a place by the beach in Santa Monica, and it was a jazz and blues club, and they also served dinner, but all the movie stars would come down to it, and all the rock stars, and Tuesday nights was blues night, and I made sure I always worked blues nights, and you know, that was a pretty big influence too, was working there. You never knew who was going to show up. I mean, one night it could be Stevie Nicks, the next night it could be Michael McDonald, you know, the next night I'm blanking out on the name, but anyway, you get the idea, just, you know, a cast of characters. Yeah, so it was a lot of fun, and I think that was one thing that kind of propelled me too. It was like, yeah, this is too much fun to never be a part of, and the best way to stay glued to it is probably to seriously work and try to become a full-time musician, or at least part-time.
Uh-huh. So is that what you're doing now?
Yeah, that's what I'm doing now. I have to do a couple other things to kind of make ends meet, but I'm a single parent, and so, yeah. So, you know, the musician thing doesn't quite pay enough of the bills for it, but, you know, it is a good supplemental, and it's fun and keeps me happy, and that's part of being a good parent.
Do you play? Where do you play around often, or where do you play in general?
Yeah, I play bass with a man named Bobby Mack, and it's a Texas blues. And mainly in Austin, the place we probably play the most consistently would be Antone's. Other than that, we play like at Green Hall in New Braunfels, Green area. We've toured Europe a couple of times. We've gone to Norway and we've gone to Ireland. And gosh, you know, Bobby's pretty popular in Blanco. He's like the interim mayor, and so kind of whenever anything comes up in Blanco, we always play there. We have the Lavender Festival booked this coming up June, which is always fun because Lavender is like, that's the biggest, a lot of people don't know it, but Blanco grows the most lavender of anywhere else. I guess it's the capital of lavender. So we'll do that, and then we play in Houston kind of regularly at a place called the Big Easy.
Okay. And so do you have any recordings, or is it you mainly playing covers?
No, Bobby is definitely more heavily into his own songwriting and doing his own thing. Of course, we throw in some standards and some R&B and some older time blues. That's more his style, along with what his originals. So Bobby does have recordings. I do not play on any of his recordings. I strictly do the live shows with him.
Okay. Now, I know that you sent us recordings of other musicians, because as Art said, these were bass players that influenced you, and we played the music of Jaco Pastorio came on, and the other piece of music you sent was from Tommy Cogbill.
Right.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Now, when I say Jaco Pastorius is an influence, I mean it more mentally than physically. Like, I don't play like him, but he's somebody that who really opened up my mind to thinking of it as a limited instrument. Like, for example, right now I'm trying to, one of my goals is to record a CD, and I want to write the songs, and I feel I find myself saying, I need to find a chordal instrument player to help me compose the arrangements. And then it's like, then I think about Jaco. I'm like, no, I don't. No, this is a chordal instrument. If you want to look at it like that, you don't need to look at it so narrow-mindedly. So, mm-hmm. So he's kind of, you know, influential as far as like, wow, you know, the world is your oyster with this instrument too. He's sort of the first person to have opened up that kind of mindset for a lot of people, including myself.
Right.
I think we all have a period of our lives in our bass playing career where we fall in love with Jaco and we become obsessed. And I think that's pretty typical for a lot of us. So myself included, but I don't have those kind of chops, but I love it. And I love listening to it before I came on. And then
okay.
Tommy Cogbill is like a more of a Nashville session player. He played with people like Dusty Springfield and Elvis Presley, Wilson Pickett, Aretha Franklin. I mean, the list goes on and on. Maybe a little bit more, slightly less sophisticated, but definitely nonetheless not losing any groove at all with that, which is, you know, which is what the majority of people really like to listen to. So he's definitely a great influence as far as that goes, and keeping that mindset also, like, hey, it doesn't have to be complicated. As a matter of fact, more people prefer to listen to less complicated bass, actually.
Right. Okay. So we're going to play that piece that you sent on our way off the show tonight. So people can stay tuned, and then they'll hear that as we go off the air. But before I have to go to what's happening next week, I'd like to have you talk about, you know, how can people find out where you're going to be performing?
Oh, okay. No, good. That's a good question. Thanks for asking. So on June 9th, we'll be at the Lavender Festival in Blanco. That is, I'm not sure what day it is. It must be a Saturday or a Sunday. I'm pretty sure it's a Saturday. And that is a daytime event. And that's a lot of fun. It's an outdoor activity with lavender everything, lavender slushies, lavender wine, lavender, lavender-colored clothing for sale and such. We'll be playing at that. We do that every year. It's kind of a tradition that we do. And then on June 16th, we will be at the Big Easy in Houston. And basically, the best way to find out is to follow me on Facebook or to become my friend on Facebook. I usually am pretty good about promoting whatever gigs we have coming up. Or to follow Bobby Mack, like his page. And that will also give people a heads up, too, as to where we will be. Bobby Mack also has a website, bobbymack.com, that people can also check out.
Okay, great. And your Facebook page is just Kim Session?
Kim Session, yes.
Okay, so I will post those links on my web post later tonight after the show, so people can just go back and click on it if they didn't have a pen and paper ready, and it'll take them to those sites.
Great, thank you.
So thank you so much for coming on the program this evening. And
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and I look forward to hearing you play sometime in person.
Yeah, that would be great. That would be awesome to meet you in person too. So we're doing this by the phone.
Yes. All right. Well, have a good evening.
Okay, you too, Mara. Thanks again, and thanks to Art also.
Okay.
All right.
You take care.
All right. Bye-bye. Thanks. You too.
All right, so we're going to play that second song that she sent, that Kim sent, as we go off the air. But before Art kicks me off the air, let me let you all know what's happening next Sunday, April 15th. We'll be back here in Austin, Texas. And as I mentioned earlier, Roberta Marcus Liner, the daughter of Rabbi Marcus Liner, who's heroic story and during and following the Holocaust is written about in this evening guest's book, Naomi Levy, in her book Einstein and the Rabbi. So now we'll have the daughter of that rabbi. And Roberta Lina has a very interesting story herself, and so we're going to be talking to her. She's in New York, and she'll be talking about living the legacy of her larger-than-life father and how it has driven her own life to create a more passionate and caring community. And that's been her goal in life and what drives her. And also musician Rochelle Rabuin will be back, and she'll be calling in from Dallas to let us know what she's been working on recently with her music. She's been on the show before, and I look forward to having her back on the program. And we'll have more. There's always more. And if you want to hear tonight's program again and read the information from this show and get the website links that my guests spoke about on the program and listen to previous programs, read my blogs, etc., go to my website page, drmaricarpel.com, and also be sure to follow me on Facebook, Dr. Mara Carpel, Your Golden Years, and The Passionate Life by Dr. Mara Carpel, two different pages. And you can listen to this evening's program in as soon as 5 minutes from now by going directly to Blog Talk Radio, blogtalkradio.com/Your Golden Years. This evening's program was produced by Accomplice Entertainment, Postal Productions, and Psyched Up Productions, and sponsored by neurologist and memory specialist Dr. Ronald DeVere and by Storyhouse. And special thanks to my guests, Naomi Levy and Kim Session. Of course, thank you, Art. And thank you all for listening. Have a peaceful night and inspiring week. And remember, youth has no age. Good night, everyone.
Any guidance offered by Dr. Carpel is not intended to replace the advice of your own physician or mental health specialist. Neither Dr. Carpel, her sponsors, nor this station assumes responsibility for the misuse of any of the information given on this show.